in all your papers, gentlemen, and I'm going to read them, and even if you copy from somebody else, I'm going to find out. I've just to separate three boys into the other course because of dishonesty, so please be careful. They have to leave college. That's really stupid. But a man who thinks that his teacher is so stupid has to be severed for all lack of intelligence. I come back to the one thing which I would like you to learn, which seems to be impossible, however, for you to understand. That there is at every moment when a man's mind is at work, that is, when he ceases from sleep. We are, after all gentlemen, in several states. Understand that while you are in the morning awakening, go to have breakfast, and then you, before you go to sleep, all day long your mind is at work by associating with the living, preferably with those people who seem to you more alive than yourself, like a beautiful girl or a wise man or the opera or the radio or whoever you listen to. But if you try to find life, to join up with us, and you try to agree in the process of joining other friends, of looking at the world together, because you are quite sure that it cannot be true if you only think of the world this way. You want to have agreement on all these your statements and ideas about the world. Before the other people, your comrades, have not agreed, there is no world in which you can trust. That's just your own imagination, wishful thinking, of course. So anybody who wakes up and takes breakfast, gentlemen, makes a decision. Here are the people in whose judgment he has to trust. And we call it his community. You call it your friends, because you overlook the fact that his friends and you speak American slang. They speak English. That's a political order inside which every word you speak makes sense. Democracy. Nobody in Iran understands democracy. They think that's a caricature when you see democracy in Iran, because that goes together with America. But you understand democracy because you live in America. So even though you don't speak to all Americans, you still are within the logos of America here. And you speak to the people who are in this logos ethically, owing each other the truth about the world. So in every minute, gentlemen, the frontiers between logos, ethos, and physis are changing. You get up, gentlemen, and you shave. As long as these whiskers are on you, they are part of you. Once they are shaved, they are thrown away. They're dead. Therefore, you have carried from the living to the dead something. It has become purely natural, whereas before, it is an integral part of the painting, the portrait, which the painter paints of you, your own beard. And so with everything, gentlemen, you show over Europe and you say, oh, Europe is dead, or you say, England made a mistake now, Eden is just finished. It's finished. Well, you can only say finished, you see, of somebody you bury. You declare to belong to the realm of the... In other words, you do it all the time. You are very cruel in this respect. There are any number of people whom you declare to have died already long ago. And probably in some cases you may be right. But I also think that most of you haven't yet been born, so I also would consider you pure nature, and I have to treat you this way. Any man who copies from another man and separate from college is treated just as an object of dismay and dismissed because he cannot be a member of this community. That's all the whole story. Would you then kindly resume, our approach now to Plato, to this quandary of every human mind who is honest with himself and who is not dealing with the trash which most of you use in your daily language. You are not aware of the fact, gentlemen, that every word that comes out of your mouth moves the frontiers between the things that are less alive than you and the people and the forces that are more alive than you. In every moment you try always to join up with the powers that be, or the powers that you think that are important, and you are going against those forces of deadness and boredom and mere quantity, which you think you can exploit, which you can cheat, or which you can manipulate. Ask yourself, gentlemen, you think, of course, you can manipulate your professors. You can perhaps also manipulate Dean McDonald. But there are certain people in the world, I'm sure, where you know very well that if you would try to manipulate them, they would lose their ultimate importance for you. People you love, gentlemen, if you would try to manipulate them, you wouldn't love them. You would know this very well. You can, of course, rape a girl or persuade a girl to sleep with you, but you know exactly, too, if you do wrong by her, that you don't love her, and that you have treated her as an object. You have treated her as physics. You have not treated her in the spirit of love. And therefore, it is your own temptation, gentlemen, your own decision how you treat this girl. In any moment you can treat anybody, God Almighty too, just as a thing to be manipulated. You can go as a hypocrite to church and say, it's good for my income tax if I go to church, because I can deduct so 10% of my income for charities. Well, you then know that you have treated God as though he was just a part of the world. And you know very well that you have deprived yourself of the possibility of living with anybody who is a little better, of a little more alive than you yourself. My whole point today is, gentlemen, that logos, ethos, and physis are your own experiences. This is important for our approach to this book, because in Plato, you see, he officially deals with everything as physis. He wants to know the physis, the nature of the state, for example. But on the other hand, he puts it in the form of dialogue. And so the funny thing is, gentlemen, the content of Plato's philosophy is nature. The form is ethical. A dialogue is an ethical form of thinking, because there are more than one person involved, and you owe each other the truth. Where's Mandeville? He isn't here today. I'm sorry, because he raised this question just last time when he read one sentence or one paragraph of Adamantus, and he said, isn't that a real contribution to the dialogue? And I had to admit it, that this was more than just a stilted form, and that more than one man were needed to know the truth. Now that's a big recognition, you see, of Plato. Plato's relation to the humanity comes out in the form of his philosophy. Plato's ideas about the world come out in the content of his philosophy. And most of you do not know, gentlemen, that form is already in itself an act of faith. If you take your hat off before an old lady, that already is an ethical act, of course. You see, you don't have to say anything, and you don't have to give me your creed that old people, you see, deserve to be kept alive and not, don't have to be shot as an old lady, or given over to starvation. Because you took off your hat before this lady, I know you have some reverence before old age, you have to say nothing. And I have to know of any philosopher how he behaves to his neighbors before I know his full philosophy. Don't you see? What he says and writes is only a little part of what he really thinks. Now, in Plato, it should be obvious to you that he is the ideal friend, because his ethical code demands that the truth is conveyed to us by several people bringing it out together. So the cooperative fellowship is constitutional for his, you see, it's fundamental to his ethics. And though he may not have written, like Aristotle, ever any treatise on friendship, that he is a good friend is implicated in the form of his words. And therefore the ethics of Plato can be fathomed in his approach, in his the form of his writings. And I thought I should try at least to convey to you my conviction that Americans
think that the ethical things should be stated in blunt sentences, be good and so. I doubt that this form of indicative statements of ethics ever work, because ethics is not something that you can write down as you can write natural science. You can say 2 and 2 is 4, but what it is to be good is so doubtful. Good is such an abstraction, you see, that if you don't give a living example how you treat your neighbor, I don't know what you're talking about. What's good? Good is what everybody thinks is good. If we wouldn't know what Plato calls the good,
we talked about it yesterday, remember?
We wouldn't know what is his good. Somebody else stopped me on the street, who was it?
Yeah, about the absolute good.
He wouldn't know about goodness if he wouldn't see this goodness at work. And we don't see goodness at work by abstract statements and by systematic statements. I can only believe that the man knows what is good by seeing it in action. Can you understand? Now, the action of Plato is the style of his work. And the thought is something different again. That's the context. It's very hard for you to understand and to believe me that ethics cannot be expressed in abstract statements. It is the curse of America that this is still believed. The result is then in the Orozco fresco of the school teacher who makes all these little children sexless, you see, and repeats stock phrases, you see. Have you this picture in mind? It's so awful. Because you don't see them behave, you see, godly or neighborly, but you only see them stand there and being filled with these silly doggerels, so to speak, on morality. The morals cannot be stated in the same way as natural facts. You can state the rose is a flower. All right, what of it, you see? But you can never say be good. Mothers say it, and they ruin their children, they get a repression, a complex. Yes, a mother who slaps her child in the face and gives her candy the next day can educate the child. But a mother who constantly says be good to a child, spoils the child, corrupts the child, ruins the child. We don't know what is good except concretely in one action. This is good, and the other thing is bad, is a wanton addition to the act. Good is a... If you have A, B, C, and you write around this good, then you only say that in your family these three things are done every time. There's breakfast, there's lunch, and there's evening supper, and then you say this is good. But without your having experienced that breakfast is, you see, appetizing and nourish you, and that luncheon is there, supper, you wouldn't know what good is, as in my paper about being, you see. Where Heraclite tries to tell Parmenides that being is only meaningful if you already know what it includes. In the same way, goodness is not meaningful unless you have acted in various ways and you remember all the positive actions, you see, and say, these I call good. Otherwise you don't know what goodness is. Now, in Plato, there is this realization that in every moment where he says something about physics, he must act ethically to the people whom he wants to convince of the truth of the nature, in nature. The truth in nature and the goodness to the people who want to share this truth must always be congruous in it. And today, I mean, throw all the books on ethics written in America in the last 100 years into the fire and they won't be missing. Because they are all trying to express ethics in terms of natural knowledge. You cannot express ethics in terms of natural knowledge. It isn't natural because it wakes up in you because you are face to face with a human being and with a definite human being. I'm good in my behavior towards my parents, and I'm good in my behavior towards you, or I'm wicked in my face of good. But in every moment, I have to believe differently.
But this is okay for the first impression, but what if you and I come from different societies, and you've been taught that this is good, and that is good, and then we try to generalize, we try to say something that's true for all of us, you see, for both of us, then don't we have to become abstract? In general.
I would be very careful at this. I would see if an American and an Englishman meet, or I have to go through this proceedings now, gentlemen, of reconciling my American citizenship and my stay here and my feeling of home here with my German relations. And you know this very well, very acutely, that I'm balancing. I shall very much avoid to have any generalization for all the world. It must be concretely between Americans and Germans. And it is this immodesty that Mr. Marley tries to tell you a world ethic instead of should be a Syrian-American ethic. Which makes me, for example, not trust Mr. Malik of Syria, who is a very good man. I mention him because I have great respect for him. But I think, do you know who he is, Malik? Who has heard of him? He has made himself quite popular. But it is an illusion to think, you see, that goodness between two concrete people, you see, can ever be expressed in generalities for the whole mankind. I give you two examples, and it's terribly important that we should now keep from Plato in this discussion just of the state, the difference between the natural aspect of any city where people have to eat and to live and to get married, that's all natural after all, because they are animals who have to exist, and goodness. The dialogue of Plato, I say, is his ethical contribution, his immense friendship. And Aristotle expressed it very beautifully. He said of Plato, "This man was so good that the wicked ones do not even have the right to praise him." That's a very wonderful saying. You see, he had this impression that on the highest level, not everybody has a right to talk. Not everybody can even judge, you see. And therefore, a man who says Plato was a good man is already taking upon himself to insist that he has a right to judge Plato. And Aristotle says, nonsense. The wicked ones have no right to praise him. The Emperor of Austria, the last great monarch of the world, John Francis Joseph, used always to say when the papers praised him for some utterance or for some act of kindness, he said, "An emperor must not be praised, ever, because then also these same people have the right to scold him. And an emperor must be beyond, you see, good and evil, or he cannot be the emperor of 14 different nations, as he was. And therefore, the praise of a man also includes the right of criticism, and so he ceases to be beyond the parties, you see. These two sentences, examples may show you, Aristotle saying of Plato and the Emperor Francis Joseph's own insight into the dangers of praise, that this presumes that the man who praises has any understanding of the quality which he praises. That would make every idiot the critic of every highest spirit in the world. It would abolish awe and reverence and respect. And it has been, of course, cauterized out of your existence very largely. America perishes because it has no respect. And so it always, since people cannot live without respect, you distribute your respect always to the idiotic values of Broadway or Dupont or rich people or some such silly asses. They don't deserve your respect and your reverence. There are other people who deserve your reverence, like Helen Keller or some such people. But you have been told, be independent, every man is as good as everybody else. Other men, I am critical, I cannot be taken in, but you cannot live without awe, you cannot live without authority. So officially in this country, the most terrible people receive celebrity. If you read the book, The Power Elite, who has seen this book? Power Elite? Haven't seen it? It's quite an interesting book because it shows how the abolition of true superiority, gentlemen, has led to the necessary substitute of false values. Nobody can live, gentlemen, without ethics, that is, without recognizing that you have people who are better than you. That's what we call ethics, and some people who are less good than you. The scale of values is in ethics always necessary. So we put this way, gentlemen. All physical facts can be expressed in the form of indicatives. that all ethical facts can only be expressed in emotional form of yes or no, in the sense of let us do this or let us avoid it. If you get a murderer, your reaction is, God forbid that I should ever be found in this situation. So a crime creates an ethical reaction in every healthy person that you don't want to be found in the same predicament. And any glorious action, like the Hungarian people now, gentlemen, that cannot be stated in the form of a report that this happened. You have to say, I'm proud of them, you see. I admire them. You remember what we said of admiration. That it is the fundamental fact that human beings are either to be admired or to be despised. Therefore, I call this not an indicative sentence, but that's always a subjective sentence. All ethical problems are problems of let me be this way or let me not be this way. That is, there are always movements back and from, away or towards. That's perhaps the best expression. All ethical statements, gentlemen, are movements away from this feature, this event, or towards this event. As long as, however, as you live in your under your physical cloud or your physicist cloud, you don't believe this. You think that ethics is a science, which of course it isn't. Ethics is a decision on who is on your side or on whose side you are, you see, and against whom you are. That is against, not in any hostile sense, but what is less important so that it can be manipulated. All the means, for example, all automobiles are just means. If a child is born, you must forget about the sale of your automobile at that moment. The child comes first. You can express it in a very simple way. First things come first. You have heard this at home probably. Your mother may have told you that first things come first. I hope she has. If she has, gentlemen, it means that in all ethical decisions, there is a hierarchy. There is something more alive and something less alive. And it is true in every minute, gentlemen, that you have to decide who is more alive so that you have to serve him and help him. If you find a great genius or poet in your community, like Robert Frost, who is going to speak to us on Thursday, obviously you go there, you flock there, I hope, because it will be your last opportunity of seeing this very great man. If you go there, you act ethically, because you acknowledge that the higher attracts the lower. You see, you don't say anything about it. You don't make a statement that you don't say much. You see, Robert Frost is a great poet. The only thing I will believe in your judgment is if he makes you go. Because you take, you see, your heart and allow your heart to speak. That's ethical. That's all it is. I want to give you two more examples because that's the terrible misunderstanding about Plato. Plato has said in his seventh letter that he never said the deepest secrets of his life in any of his books. And so I have to, at this moment, what do? I draw your attention to the fact that his life was his ethics. His life is his faith. And that he impressed people as a saint, as the greatest spirit of antiquity, because of this sincerity of his dealing with his friends or with his people. And we know from his seventh letter that the best is not expressed in his dialogues. And I would therefore say the best, however, appears in the form of these dialogues at least. We have an idea how smiling, how cheerful, how merciful, how ironical, how sympathetic, how sharp, how he could be when he was speaking with his friends. You see, in the dialogue, he gives away his dramatic secret of being a person acting out his role in life within a company, godly company of men. Gentlemen, I once was in a difficult position in the army in the First World War. It was the Battle of the Somme, and I was suddenly
got the report that my youngest officer was only 18 years old and an ensign. The boy had been found sleeping on guard. You know you are spelled every 2 hours on the military guard. The battle was raging, and so, of course, it was a very terrible crime. And in normal, under the code or penal code of any army, a man who is found sleeping on guard has to be shot. At least he has to be court-martialed, and he certainly would, as an officer, be immediately degraded, lose his qualities. So life and honor both were at stake with this man. And he came before me to report his case, because he had been reported before with a helmet on and all the bandolier and everything, as we say, in full glory, battle dress glory. Dirty it was. It was November. It was a very hard time for everybody. And here was this boy, and his whole future was at stake. And if I had acted out my simple military duty, he would have been ruined for life. On the other hand, gentlemen, it was serious business, and something very drastic had to happen. I couldn't let this pass. And I couldn't say, I shall use words, couldn't say in an indicative sentence, as you would think, you see, from the morality of your little schoolhouse teacher, a sermon would do. No sermon could make up for his crime, because he had led down after all the army in a battle. And I want to repeat, gentlemen, ethics is never to be stated in the form of a proposition. Wake up to this fact, and you suddenly cease to be so superstitious as you all are. You think that ethics is a part of your worldly knowledge. It is the knowledge of your, the community, the polis in which you really think to live. And in the community one does move and is moving, but never makes reasoned statements and judgments, because judge not lest ye be judged. It is not my business to judge such a man, gentlemen, but to do something with him. If you could only understand this. You are all judges of the whole rest of the world all the time, because you are so frightened that you might be shaken out of your intellectual security. As long as you think that I am under your judgment, gentlemen, you treat me as a piece of nature. Because you put me outside of you somewhere. I'm then not a part of your own life.
I may interrupt this by a kind of excursus. On the last Thursday we had the installation of a minister, and the charge in such an installation is given by another minister, telling him what to do. The other minister had been his co-pastor in Keene, New Hampshire, and for the last 3 years. And he said, "Thank you, Roy, for the kindness which you have shown to me. You were asked to pass judgment on me to the board of appointments for the ministry in Boston, and they asked you, gave you a questionnaire, and you wrote back, 'This man is an integral part of myself at this moment. We are brothers here in arms, and as long as we are together, I shall not pass any judgment on him. I shall not answer any of your questionnaires. It would be a break of the unity inside of us, where I must not even try to reason what qualifications he has. He's just part of me and I'm part of him, and just as little as I know really to judge myself, I shall not give you any such qualifications." And that then the minister also mentioned that his comrade in Keene had done this after some consultation of myself, that we had been in cahoots and had been thinking, could a man in moral, in honesty, serve the congregation as a minister with another man, and at the same time sit down and say, he is such and such, you see, he's good or he's bad, and the result was, he cannot. If you pass such a judgment, the man is outside you, and then he has become a part of nature. So it's morally very important, gentlemen, that you understand this. then you wouldn't answer such questionnaires as Mr. Bender here used to put out. Whom do you love more, your father or your mother? That's the, you see, that's the devil's question. In the moment you answer this question, you have ceased to love either your father or your mother, or both. If you cannot understand this, you see, you are lost to philosophy. Because philosophy knows of the separation of the ethical attitude and the worldly, the physical attitude. And if you think that your father and your mother are part of the physical world, then you can say whom you love more. But then you neither know what a father is, nor do you know what a mother is, nor do you know what love is. You think love is a fact. Love is something that at this moment you have to battle for. You have to pray that your love doesn't give out. And how can you continue to love if you dissect it and try to know who is deader? One of the two you put on the dump by making this decision. And I hope you will never know whom you love more, your father or your mother. I couldn't tell to this day whom I have loved more. They are both dead. But do you think I know? And I don't want to know. There are things that you must not know in generalization, sir. This is what you see, try to think, that there could be general statements of this nature. They must not be. They must not be tried. But you must move back and forth towards and away from things. Well, what did I do in the battlefield on the battlefield of the Somme in 1916? Gentlemen, I slapped this man as heartily as I could into his face. And there was the staff sergeant, and there were several men, and they saw it. And that was his redemption. And I decided that by slapping him in the face, I could get him. I treated him as a boy. He was 18, after all. You can treat such a man as a boy. And therefore, I declared him simply not to have been of age at that moment of his action, and everybody was very happy. 7 years later, the boy brought me his wife and said, "Here is the man who saved my life," to her. And that is, may have been, may be qualified as ethical truth, which I discovered at that moment, that I had to create a new relation to this man. In treating him as a child, as a boy, I could get him out of his position as an officer. It was, in a way, a momentary degradation, because you don't slap an officer in the face. But should I wait till he was degraded in actu by the authorities, by the martial court? Would this have been wiser? You would, of course, stand this, because you think it is unethical to bank a person. Now, I assure you, gentlemen, it is much more ethical to slap a man in the face than to have him degraded and put for 10 years into prison. But you don't understand it, and that's why you don't understand the Suez Canal. Yes, you can't. You have ethical statements that it's always bad to hit a man. It is not always bad to hit a man. It is sometimes bad. I don't say that you always have to hit a man when he has slept on guard. I claim, gentlemen, that any ethical act is unique, singular, and can never be repeated. And you must never recommend an act because it has happened before. You see, there's no reason to repeat any such action. That doesn't abolish the fact that it was necessary to do it at that moment. If you can begin to understand it, you see why an ethical act cannot be generalized, sir. It loses its character of an ethical action when it is repeatable, then it is a legal action. And the law, you see, is the first naturalization of a unique action. If you say, I can write something into a law and becomes repetitive, then I treat it already as an external thing of outside nature, you see. The way from the act into the law, gentlemen, is the way from ethics into physics. Would you take this down? The way from the unique act into the law is the way from ethics into physics. And so we get quite a series of things, you see. Here is the spirit, the logos. He says to me, save this man, you see. And I try to find a way out, and I treat him as a child. I slap him in the face. If this would be found out to be an excellent way of saving people's lives by a momentary act, as in school, for example, that I have to dismiss the man from college because I have justice has been done and he can stay, then I would make it a habit. And then I would make it a law, so you have the act, you have the habit,
or the president is perhaps better, and you have the law, and finally you have the natural law. And you see how important it then is that you see the connection between the ethical world and the world of nature by the concept of the law. Ethics are always transformed into physics. Law is experienced act, respected as precedent, transformed into rule and regulation, you see, and finally applied to outside, the world outside, as always having this implication, you see. For example, you say, of course the people reacted in Hungary. Now, there you take it as a natural phenomenon, you see. But of course, if people hadn't once rebelled with this in this glorious way, as they do now, you see, you wouldn't know this. It first had to happen in an ethical context, you see, that you could admire it. You will think the other way around. You think first there are laws in the universe, and then there are acts. And that's why you are no longer free men. My slapping this boy in the face is such an example of freedom, because it was nowhere in the context of any natural or martial law or civil law that there was this response possible to such a serious action. If you cannot see this, gentlemen, that all actions in the New Testament are invented by Jesus on the spot, you don't understand the New Testament. When the adulteress is brought before him, what does he do? He says, what does he do? How is he? Has he judged the adulterers? Yes, and what happens? They all go away. They all go away. He creates an absolutely new situation. Nobody accuses her anymore. Don't you understand? So he creates suddenly a sphere of peace and protection for her, because all the other people withhold, you see, withdraw. You must just see this lively, that he creates this new dimension which hasn't existed before. The dimension in which people see suddenly that they themselves, you see, have tried to judge instead of knowing that they also are judged. It's always the same thing in ethics, you see. As soon as you say that you are under judgment, you stop judging. Gentlemen, the gist of the matter is this. The only ethical law which is adamant is that a man who is of age has to listen to the experience of the ages. Before you elope with a girl, you are not competent to cope with the problem if you cannot hear the voices that contradict your move, that warn you against it. You see? If you are just in a frenzy, you must expect the full fury of the law and of wisdom and of precedent coming upon you, because you have acted, you see, without listening. So, gentlemen, the logos is the ruler of the ethos, because to listen means to let the intellect, the spirit, enter your mind. You must be willing to bring your ethical action under the word. And that's why the whole Bible is written around the word, of course, gentlemen. The word precedes the act, and the act begets the law. The words of the past, the words of wisdom, the words of experience, the words of suffering, the words of love and sympathy, a man must listen to. Listen, or hearken Israel, it is called in the Old Testament. Listen or hearken is the one ethical command that is true, that is permanent. I had at that moment to consider, had I not, that it wasn't an action of mine of mere rashness that I slapped this boy. It was an act by which I tried to contradict the authorities who said he has to be court-martialed. This, I mean, if you can think this through, is an intellectual act on my part, is it not? I had to face up to the rules of the game as they had existed so long and so far. This is intellectual. This is logos. Can you see this? Before I made my own original contribution, I have first to weigh whether any of the precedents would have done the trick. The same trick, you see. Perhaps then I would have had to fulfill it, you see. If
court-martialing would not have entailed his utter ruin. I would have, and in other cases of death, you see. Think of the Marine Corps. There was no way out. You had to go to the court with him. But then he could be tried. So it is the hardest thing for you to understand the relation of logos, ethos, and citizen. I try to do it today because I think if you could see this, you understand the great philosophy. The Greeks had always this relation between the knowledge of what is good by precedent, by what already was known to be wise men's acts. The problem of friendship, that is, what to do to a person you are in sympathy with at this moment. Now, just take prohibition era and a man who gets drunk, and you are for prohibition. That doesn't help you at all. When the man is drunk, you have to take care of him, have you not? Take a 90 or 22 or 90 or 23. You are against drinking, you see, but your best friend gets drunk. What do you do? Can you simply say he shouldn't have got drunk? Doesn't help you at all. There you are. You have to treat him as your friend. So ethics, you see, must say, too bad. Prohibition really should have been followed. You must listen to the law. But you can also create for this friend, you see, a refuge from the law. You must. So all the time, gentlemen, the word in the sense of already intellectual preparation, of foreknowledge, of anticipation, is with us. Everything has already been thought through in some form. With regard, either the existing social order tells you about any action, this you can do or that you cannot do. It does not, however, help you at all, because you must know when do you have to break the law and when do you have to follow it, you see. Any minute you have to create actions which are far beyond anything that could have been foreseen before. But you have to have listened to the words of the wise. You have to be a law-abiding citizen in the sense that you must know what the law is. I once challenged another student in the University of Heidelberg to a duel. I went to a very fine man. His father was prime minister of one of the German states, and though he was quite high up in the ranks of authority and loyalty and good behavior. And he had just received been made baron. And he was quite proud of the new title of baron, of Freiherr. And I asked him to be my second. You know, you have to send to the other fellow whom you challenge a man. When he's in your stead, you can't see him yourself, and he has to organize the conditions of the battle. And so he said, well, I said, would you do this? And he said, yes. And then, after everything was settled, he said to me, before leaving the room, he said, well, you have studied the law. He was a medical student. So you tell me. That's punishable under the law, is it not? It's an infraction. Of course, duels were forbidden, you see, officially in the penal court. And I said, yes, it is punishable. And he said, it doesn't make any difference to me, but I still wanted to know. And I think that was a very good and sober statement. He wanted to know that he was breaking the law, and then he decided to do it just the same. You see? He has never been rash in his life. He was still alive, and a very, very slow, meditative, and important man. He's the greatest doctor, considered to be the greatest doctor of Germany at this moment. And he said this very wonderful saying. It is punishable, is it not? You see? I'm going through with it just the same. That's ethics, sir. So please take this down, gentlemen. The relation of ethics to logos is that the logos comes first. It must be, and you must listen before you, otherwise you are a wild animal. If you then feel called urged to add to the existing code, you are acts of freedom, you see. You have not broken the law, you see, in the same sense as an animal, which has to be punished because it was just out of bounds. It's very strangely unknown in this country. You see, you think the ethical command is both intellectual and truthful, you see, and good. The true and the good and the beautiful answer is simply, the stream of consciousness reaches you through what is said as aura. Then your neighbor simply impresses you with the necessity of sympathetic or antithetic action, whatever it is. And that provokes you to your new response. And that is up to you. And you never know whether you should follow the law or should not follow the law. In 99 cases, you may be perfectly safe just to do what the law requires. I don't say at all that in many cases you will never feel any conflict between what the law requires and you doing what you have to do. But the one case is important, which explains what is ethics. Ethics is when it is upon your conscience. Here, where is this man Forrester? Forrester.
Unfortunately.
No, the other wrong one.
But he has
left. Well, I just had a discussion with a man who called the conscience a dynamic thing, a dynamic conscience. I said, well, here you are.
See? Porter.
Oh, kindly, Porter. So, Mr. Porter, you see, now you know why there is no dynamic conscience. There is conscience against science, knowledge, you see. Your conscience, you see, must be informed, you see, about the existing law. And then your conscience is creative at that moment. Under the impact of what has been said and the conflict with what is there, you see, you make your decision. Can you see the difference? Let's go back now to the text after a little break, 5 minutes.
And really, I should not have thought the true lawgiver ought to have the trouble of working out things of that sort in laws or constitutions, either in a badly or in a well-governed city. In the one, because they are useless and do no good, the other because sometimes they follow naturally from former conduct, or if not, anyone could find out what to do.
Then what more could be left for us in our legislation?
For us, nothing, but for Apollo in Delphi, the greatest and finest and first of enactment.
Now, just to show you the absolute indifference, this we had read already, and nobody told me this. Terrible.
The founding of temples and sacrifices and worship of gods and spirits and heroes aside. Tombs of the departed again. And whatever service is due to those who are in the next world to keep them gracious. For these are matters we do not know ourselves. And in founding a city we will obey no man if we have sense. And we will use no interpreter except the God of our fathers. For this God, as I take it, is the ancestral interpreter on such matters for all mankind. And he sits in the middle of the earth upon the navel and interprets.
Well, there's an old saying, gentlemen, which you just as well may retain, repetitio mater studiorum. Repetition is the mother of studies. So we have read this last time, so we read it here again. I told you something about the center of the universe. Gentlemen, in the Bible and in Christianity, the middle of the universe is in time. Christ is the center of history. In Greek thinking, since time is cyclical and just moving in cycles, and in circles, I'm afraid too, the problem is to find the navel of the universe, the center, you see. And that's why you know that we have a Greek book which is called the Encyclopedia Britannica, which means the knowledge in a circle, encyclo, that's encyclopedia, you see. To be educated, paideia means, with the Greek word here of Plato, education. And this is then, gentlemen, the seat, the center paragraph in the heart of the Republic by which you can get hold of the Greek organized mentality. The idea is to be in the center of the universe. In Boston they call it how?
Public.
to have of the universe, you see, and as considered a wheel. But the whole problem is always thinking in terms of space. You are in the middle of something you can mentally overlook. This is important, gentlemen. You must get hold of the fact, what is the Greek, what is mind, what is humanism. You are all thinking that humanism is something that can stand on its own legs. Humanism is the arbitrary half of reality. It's trying to organize the world as space. You are sitting in the middle of the universe and you look at it out into the periphery. And you buy the Encyclopedia Britannica as though this was the periphery of all your knowledge, and inside of this you sit in your museum or however you call it. And anybody who has looked through this Greek thing knows, of course, that this is a strange abstraction, that it is much more important to have the book of books, which is written in 1500 or 2000 years and can be continued backwards to the beginning of the history and downward to the last days of judgment. The title of the Bible, gentlemen, is Book of Books, as you know. The Bible is not a book, but Biblion in Greek means book, and it means the book of books. That is, all the books written, ever written, have their meaning in this. That is the antithesis to the Greek mind. And you and I, gentlemen, we are condemned to deal with two possible mentalities. One thinking in terms of time, and one thinking in terms of space. And Plato is only, I'm afraid, one half of the approach to reality which you always try. Oh, Mr. Batchelder? No, pardon me. Please. By all means. That's why at this point here we may stop, and because we have reached the center, naive, very naive statement of Plato. He thinks that this is not ridiculous. To you, to speak of the navel in Delphi as the center of the orb, we have no approach anymore. But in the sublimation of the Encyclopedia Britannica, we still all believe in it. And here you can see the difference, gentlemen, between the conditions of the philosophical mind, first impressions, where there is an Apollo in Delphi sitting on the priest is sitting on the tripod and it's called the navel of the earth. The Greeks may make out of this an ideal world. The very word ideal comes in here, you see, and says to you and me, let's have an encyclopedic knowledge. Gentlemen, an encyclopedic knowledge of the universe does paralyze us. You take a man who knows the Encyclopedia Britannica by heart, what about his ethics? Can he act? Can he be a statesman? You see, he cannot, because he knows so many things that he cannot possibly know what to do next. It's impossible for him, you see, because he knows too many things. The problem of a statesman is to know what next. In other words, to rule a state, you have to know the timing. The problem of timing is the essential political quality. And therefore, philosophers must never be kings. And as you know, Plato has put in the Republic before us the solution that if philosophers could be kings, then the state would be in the best of shape. This is the ultimate in space thinking that has ever been thought of, and whenever this comes true, gentlemen, you get the cruelty of the Bolsheviks. In Bolshevism, the philosopher is king, and you cannot breathe. There's no freedom. You are just a part of a system, of his system. He has thought out every law, and the natural relation of logos, ethos, and physics is destroyed. As soon as a philosopher is king, I'm afraid ethos and physics coincide. In one form or other, you see, the physical law and the mental law of your own mind crush any freedom of between friends. this you must see. And it is the strange thing is that on page 225, which is usually overread by most of you gentlemen, and in America nobody pays any attention to this sentence about Apollo. It looks so perfectly silly, and who is interested in Plato in the navel of Delphi? Yet you have the heart of the matter. To think that a philosopher can be king is exactly the same as thinking that you can know the center of the universe. Because then you construe a world inside of which, by total knowledge, you know everything potentially what has to be done. But the only thing, gentlemen, that a man in life must know is what next. You will be very happy if you know what to do next. I assure you, nobody knows what to do after next. Nobody, you see, even the wisest one doesn't. And so it is much more difficult to know what is next, you see, than to know everything. Because next is not everything, and everything is not next. Next does not exist in Plato's philosophy. Because all philosophy cuts up the reality into space. An outer world of nature, an inner world of ethical conjunction, you see, and a world from above of inspiration of logos, which tells you what you are up against with regard to your comrades in arms or your co-citizens or your family, and with regard to the plants and stones and mountains and enemies outside. But it never tells you of history. Plato is anti-historical, gentlemen. Plato is utopian. And therefore, today, gentlemen, the Republic, I think, is a very dangerous book. If you would take the Republic literally, you would become slave drivers. You would become administrators of forced labor camps, etc. And all the Russians, Mr. Lenin and more than anybody else, are Platonists. But it's a tremendous temptation. I think most of you are under this spell. Shall we now go on to the fifth book, please? Page 246.
Then good and upright, I call such a city and constitution, and such a man. Bad and blundering, the others. If this one is right, both in the management of cities and their manner of furnishing the soul of individual citizens. There are classical four conditions of wickedness. What are these? I was going on to give a list of them in order, as they appear to follow one after another, when Polymarchos, who sat a little way from Adamantos, stretched out a hand and caught hold of the upper part of his brother's wrap near the shoulder, pulled him towards himself, and, leaning forward, whispered something in his ear. We could not catch what it was except this. Shall we put him off, then? Or what shall we do?
You take Adamantos.
Oh, let him off. No.
Huh?
I said, exactly, why don't you two let off?
Huh?
You.
But why exactly?
You are shirking, we think. You are cheating us out of a whole chapter of the discussion, and by no means the smallest, because you don't want to discuss it. Do you imagine you will get away with the remarks you dropped in that light way? What was it about women and children clear to anyone, did you say? That friends will have all in common?
Well, wasn't that quite right, Adamantus?
Yes, but just that, quite right, wants explaining, like the rest of it, how they shall be in common. There might be many ways, so don't fail to tell us which way you mean. We've been waiting ever so long, hoping to hear what you will have to say about child getting. How will they get children? How will they train them when they have come? And all this community of wives and children of which you speak, we think it will have a great and capital effect on the state, according as it is rightly or wrongly done. You are putting your hand to another constitution before you have properly finished it. And so, as you heard, we are now resolved not to let you go before you discuss all these things like the rest.
No, somebody playing the glaucon. Here.
Put me down as voting likewise for that.
And Trasimov said, oh yes, we are all decided on this, Socrates. Take that for granted.
Oh dear me, what a thing you have done challenging me like this. What a debate you are stirring up. It looks like doing the Constitution again from the beginning. I thought I had finished now, and glad indeed I was. Quite happy if I could just be accepted and left alone as described. And now you demand all this too. You can't imagine what a hornet's nest of words you are waking. But I saw it and passed it by to prevent trouble.
My dear man, that's what these people have come for. They left all to come and hear words. Do you suppose they are looking for a gold mine?
Words, yes, but not words without end. You must draw the line somewhere.
Draw the line at the end of life, Socrates. For men having sense, when words can be heard such as these. But never mind us, just get on and answer our questions. Tell a story in your own way, only don't give up. What will be this community?
Well, just stop here. Gentlemen, here this is an example of the best ethics of Plato. You remember that I said the dialogue is the ethics of Plato, the form of the dialogue. Now here are four men coming in, two first, and then Glaucon and Trasimachus and Polemarchus joining him, isn't that right? Yes. And there are the first expressions of timing. If you look at the paragraph, a sentence I had to read, of course, no, today it's always overread. These are problems of waiting, of expectation, and he said that this may go on, draw the line at the end of life. These are all temporary notions. Ethics has always to do with time. The whole problem of a moral life between citizens, gentlemen, between good people, is when to tell your mother that you are going to marry this girl. You can break the confidence and trust of your good girl if you say it too early. You can lose the confidence of your mother if you say it too late. The whole problem of telling your parents whom you are going to marry, it's always a tragic news to them, is to know when it has to be said. Never too early, gentlemen. Don't rush when you have seen a girl once and tell your mother at home, this is the girl I'm going to marry. Because you aren't going to marry the girl if you have to tell her too early. I assure you. Premature saying is just immature saying. And immature love shouldn't get married. So wait long enough until you have proven to yourself that you can keep a secret. And tell people so that you can show to yourself that you have the stamina to confess to the world what your opinion is. It has to be weighed both ways. All the time, gentlemen, ethics have to do with timing. And in this dialogue, every good ethical statement comes from the relation of the speakers. Here these men say, you aren't through, you made it too much in a hurry, you see. Dwell on this. He says, well, I didn't want to stir up a hornet's nest. These are all profound moral quandaries. These are the real problems in life, gentlemen. Ethics is the problem of timing. Physics is the problem of spacing. We have to posit, to place a thing, makes you the expert on a thing. We have to put things, then you know what things are. But when to say things or when to be silent, so that you are a human being. A man who cannot keep a secret doesn't know what ethics is. You see, in this country where everything is publicized, when Mr. Hoover Jr. lost his pants and had to be woken up at 2 o'clock or 4 o'clock at night because of the Suez issue and was found trembling, Drew Pearson could write it up the next day in his terrible letter, and we knew that there was panic in Washington. Gentlemen, a great nation cannot afford to appear as panicky in the eyes of the rest of the world. That's high treason. I would have said this is high treason. Because if the government was panicky, I don't want to believe it, then it should not be told. It's terrible that the Russians could then laugh at us and say, we have driven the Americans, you see, into a panic. Then, of course, they can say, we sent volunteers to Egypt. That's what they said next day. If they hadn't known that we had lost our courage, they wouldn't have said that. So, gentlemen, this is very difficult for you to understand because it brings up the whole question of knowledge. If you have only physis and logos, then all knowledge is good. If you have any ethical situation, gentlemen, then knowledge has to be timed. And certain things must not be known, you see, by everybody. Knowledge, too, has its history, and knowledge has its timing. And if we wouldn't have this terrible publicity stunt in this country and the quiz kids and all this nonsense, if you hadn't the dogma that knowledge can be made known to all people at all times, where the result is that you can't have any foreign policy. And that we always lose the initiative, that we always are licked, because in a democracy, you have to tell everything to everybody. So you can only talk about unimportant things. What you can tell all the people, gentlemen, isn't worth telling. Theodore Roosevelt had a postmaster general who wrote his memoirs. And he said that when the Russians went to war against the Japanese, 1904 and 5, there was a famous battle of Tsushima, you may have heard of this, in which Togo, Japanese admiral, defeated Mr. Rozhestvensky and his Russian fleet when they came into the straits between Korea and Japan. And Mr. Van der Lengacke, I think it's his name or something like that, German descent, he was, writes in his memoirs, we were all agreed in Washington that in our case, in such a war, we couldn't have delivered this fatal blow to the Russian fleet because the Japanese fleet had to be in the Straits of Tsushima for 6 weeks in advance because it was so uncertain when the Russians would finally get there. Now, it is impossible in America to keep a secret where the whole American fleet is for 6 weeks from the public. Our democratic way of life just wouldn't make a victory as in Tsushima utterly impossible. That is a good example, I think, of, you see, the problem of ethics. Ethics always will divide the world of knowledge into silence or secret and revelation. Opening, you see. Knowledge about nature doesn't know this distinction. There is no distinction between what you know of plants today and tomorrow. Let's know all the facts, because they're dead. But the Battle of Tsushima is a secret. You can see how the tragedy of the last 20 years, Mr. McCarthy, has been this naivete that all the facts can always be known, and that the atom bomb can be given to the Russians, you see, because why not? Everybody must know everything. From a scientific point about natural science, it's perfectly logical, you see, that everything can be known by everybody at all times. From the point of security of the United States, you see, it's high treason if you do so. The whole problem of the trial of the Rosenbergs is here involved, you see. From a purely knowledgeable point of view, what is knowledge, you can never say why not. This is physics, you see, and in physics, there is no distinction between secret and open publicity. And you try to treat politics as publicity stunts, and therefore senators have to debate with quiz kids. Well, if this is so, then the senator is an unimportant person, because I'm only interested in my good senator from Vermont, Senator Aiken and Senator Flanders, because I think these two men can keep a secret. And therefore I trust them. A representative government is impossible if you don't trust people that they can keep a secret and that I can rely on their doing a good thing without my knowing. If you have to tell everything to your constituency, you are unnecessary. You are just a mail carrier. And we have today, as you know, the system of mail carrier, that these poor boys in the morning have to count the letters they receive from the public. Now, how can I know what these people know in Washington? I hope they know a little more than I, because they have their secrets. In their committees, they know facts I do not know. And they cannot tell me everything at once, why they have to vote in this manner or in this manner. I can, of course, show them my trend of thought, but if they do otherwise, I have to feel they had good reasons for doing this. Don't you understand that you can't have representative government unless you assume that people going to Washington have a little more insight than you have? But you don't believe this. And that's why the Congress has nothing to say anymore. As soon as you, as the representative in Washington, is only reporting that 1,500 letters were in favor and 200 letters were against it, he's absolutely superfluous. Because if he then has to decide by the 1,500 letters, why don't you send him to Washington? You can have a referendum on this. And you don't have to have any representative government. So ethics, gentlemen, have to do with these two things: timing, secret, and diverging secrets. And without secrets, there is no life. Any life needs secrets. And people are so dead in the modern world because they have no secrets. They don't know what a secret is. A secret is simply something that has still to grow into public life because it is immature. And it is as any bird before the leaves open. Gentlemen, nothing can bud, after all, into a flower that hasn't gone through this process of ripening. A diplomat visited me a fortnight ago and he said to me, nothing can grow anymore. We had it, it was just after the Suez incident. It all was growing up, a nice peaceful understanding between the various nations, but this damn publicity has destroyed everything. He didn't go into the details, he just came from Europe after a number of interviews with, conversations with statesmen there, and he said, it is simply terrible, the general public has to be taken so much into confidence all the time, prematurely. You know, treaties is arrived at in public discussion and open agreements, this famous phrase of Wilson. Have you heard, what's the phrase, you remember?
Open treaties openly arrived at.
Yes, openly arrived at. Well, what can you openly arrive at? You cannot propose to your girl on Times Square with all the lights playing and floodlights playing on you. Well, all life is like proposing to somebody and being accepted. I only wanted to make you see an example of what I call ethics. The first two pages of the book 5 of Plato's statements, of course, they are always read omitted, so to speak, from the picture. They don't seem to be important. Yet they give you the tact, the artistry of Plato. As a dramatist, as a former playwright and poet, Plato had, of course, a deep, very deep understanding into the process of timing, when to say something. And here, this is one of the most famous places of retardation. As you know, all great art is retardation. That's why the movies are not interesting as art, because they don't know how to retard. They always think they must promise you quick communication. Say everything at once. Far too much. Rush. Quick, 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 shoot, shoot, shoot. Don't bore people, don't stop them. Well, all great art begins, gentlemen, in such a way that you know the whole story in advance. In the first verse of Homer, of the Iliad, you know the whole end of the Iliad. Then it goes on for 24 hours, and that's great art. There you are treated as an ethical comrade who undergoes the tension and the expectation and the disappointment, although you know the whole outcome. You read it breathlessly. In a movie, as you know, you don't know a detective story. That's the most stupid kind of literature there is. Mystery stories, only for idiots and mathematicians. And, yes. You see, because in a mystery story, you are kept, that's no art. You see, in the last line, you finally know who murdered the child. I don't want to know that. I'm not interested. The murder shouldn't have been committed, that's all. And that's interesting. But who murdered the child?